From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. Staff at Lee Memorial Health System's Golisano Children's Hospital in Fort Myers have teamed up with Miami Children's Hospital in a new clinical affiliation intended to improve treatments for severely sick or injured children and to help keep pediatric patients closer to home while in recovery. We'll take a closer look at how the clinical partnership is designed and what it will mean for pediatric patients and their families. Plus, next week marks a dark chapter in Fort Myers history. May 25th and 26th will mark the 90th anniversary of the lynching of two black teens in the city. We'll step back into our region's history for a closer examination of what's known about the lynchings and their impact, along with a broader look at the phenomenon of lynching in the U.S. First, this news. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. Next week marks the 90th anniversary of the lynching of two black teens in Fort Myers. On May 24th and 25th of 1924, 16-year-old Milton Williams and 14-year-old R.J. Johnson were accused of sexually assaulting two white girls and were beaten, mutilated, shot, dragged through the streets, and hung in Fort Myers. In a 1976 article, the news press reported an eyewitness said the girls in question had actually been friends with the two black teens, and one had protested that they'd done nothing wrong. A jury later ruled in the case that the two boys met their deaths, quote, at the hands of parties unknown, even though the lynchings were intentionally carried out as a sort of public spectacle. The murders of Williams and Johnson were hardly an isolated incident. Although it's unlikely that a complete record of lynching in the U.S. exists, the Tuskegee Institute has recorded the lynchings of more than 3,400 blacks in the U.S. between 1882 and 1964. And between 1882 and 1930, Florida led the nation in the per capita number of lynchings of African Americans. We'll mark the anniversary of this dark chapter in local history with a closer look at what's known about the lynchings of R.J. Johnson and Milton Williams and their impact on the community. We'll also be taking a broader look at the phenomenon of lynching in our nation's history. As an advisory to listeners, some of the descriptions in the conversation may be upsetting or disturbing to some listeners. And joining me now in studio is Dr. Jonathan Harrison. He's an adjunct sociology professor here at Florida Gulf Coast University and at Hodges University, and his research interests include the history of African Americans in Florida. Dr. Harrison, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
We're also talking with self-described picker and collector James Allen. Allen has collected more than 100 photographs and postcards documenting lynchings throughout the U.S., carried out between the late 1800s and through the 1950s. These images have been collected in the book Without Sanctuary and have also been the subject of museum exhibits. Many of the images and historical descriptions can be found online at withoutsanctuary.com. James Allen, thanks for your time this morning and welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Well, thanks for including me, Mr. Davis.
I invite our listeners to join the conversation as well. Share your comments or questions about the phenomenon of lynching in our nation's history. You can connect with our guests with a phone call to 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org or post your comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media. And Dr. Harrison, I'd like to start with you. Before we talk specifically about the Fort Myers lynchings, we're coming up on the 90th anniversary of, tell us a bit about the historical context that could shed some light on how this phenomenon of lynching became as prolific as it did.
Yeah, I think the main issue is that the white community at that time had certain stereotypical beliefs about African Americans. They believed that African American males were violent, and especially sexually, that they were sexual predators. So whenever an African American male came within a certain distance of a white female, it would lead to a certain reaction. And that's what we saw in the Fort Myers case. In addition, I think in Florida, because Florida had – the reason why Florida had this higher per capita rate was because it had more population movement. And when you have more population moving around, it creates instability because the people who had the privileges, the white supremacist privileges in the previous population, they want to make sure that they keep these privileges. And so they use violence as a way of – maintaining the boundaries. They say to the white population, you mustn't cross this boundary, and the black population, you must not cross this boundary. So it's a, and because in 1920, The Fort Myers population was only 3,500. It grew rapidly to 9,500 by 1925. I think the lynching can be partly explained as that population growth and the white population saying we need to keep a lid on this and make sure that the blacks remain within the boundaries of the previous white supremacist system.
And I know this is something that you've researched extensively. How would you characterize, you know, what the experience of being an African American in Fort Myers at that time would have been like? Was this a fully segregated town?
It was a fully segregated town, yeah. After the railroad arrived in 1904, the African American community was gradually moved over to the east of the line into this place that was called Safety Hill. Now it's later became known as Dunbar, but at that time it was Safety Hill. They weren't allowed to go west of the tracks after dark. The police often went into Safety Hill and would carry out roundups of suspicious-looking characters. I think an ordinary African-American would be constantly looking over his shoulder, constantly aware of being seen as a potential menace, someone who could always... As soon as you saw a white person, you had to change your behavior, or that you may end up being arrested or beaten or, in this case, even lynched.
Interesting. You know, obviously, lynching is not carried out today, but many of the descriptions that you describe, I have heard from African-American friends that's still a perception that they feel somewhat today.
Yeah, you're constantly watching over your shoulder. And we saw it. A recent movie, The Butler, about someone who's constantly having to monitor his behavior. You have to perform a certain role still if you're African-American, so you don't upset people's stereotypes and expectations of how a black person should behave.
Mm-hmm. In your writing, you cite the work of the late Southern historian Bertram Wyatt Brown. How does he explain the phenomenon of lynching?
He says that there was a ritual called charivari, which went right back to medieval Europe. And so going right back into the Middle Ages, there would be public rituals, these big ceremonies. A person who'd accused of breaking the law would be taken out into the street. Tarring and feathering seems to come from that tradition. Beating, whipping... putting people against a whipping post. All of these brutalities were carried out in the medieval period, and they seem to have been brought to the United States by the settlers who came over. And the United States, of course, initially was a wilderness, a frontier society. There was very little law and order. So these lynching rituals became a way initially of maintaining the social order in this first phase. But then after the Civil War and the blacks got their freedom, supposedly, it was then transferred to become mainly a way of maintaining a racial social order. So any black person who breaks these rules would be subjected then to tarring and feathering, beating and lynching.
Right. And looking specifically at this R.J. Johnson and Milton Williams case that we're coming up on the 90th anniversary of, I gave a brief description of what occurred at the beginning of the program, but can you give us more details on what's known today about that case and where that information comes from?
Yeah, there was an investigation in 1976 by Steve Drority, which I relied on quite a lot. I found it was published on April 25th, 1976. He interviewed several witnesses. What seems to have happened is that the two teenagers were skinny dipping with the two girls. They knew the girls from previous. We have testimony from Mary Primus Ware, who was a friend of the victims, that she says that the victims knew the girls from previous. Someone saw them skinny dipping, and because they had this prejudiced view, they assumed that the boys must be attacking the girls. So then the eyewitness, the person who witnesses them skinny dipping, he reports this to the people who become the lynch mob. The lynch mob capture the first person, the first victim. They take him to before one of the girls. The girl says the boy is innocent, but the lynch mob refuses to believe her. And so the first boy is killed. And then the second boy is found later. He's found hiding in a rail car. And so the lynching takes place over 2 days because they were found separately. The first boy is lynched. The second boy is lynched. One of the boys is lynched. The first boy was lynched by being hung from a tree, which was on Edison Avenue. And then his body was dragged up Cranford. The second boy, his body was dragged up Cranford as well and eventually was hung from a lamppost. Mutilation of the body was quite common in lynchings. If it was a sexual crime that they were accused of, that there may have been a sexual mutilation of the bodies.
Yeah, I've heard that was common in other cases.
Very,
as well.
Very common, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
And how was this case characterized in the media? There was one headline that you had sent me.
Yeah, the Fort Myers Press reported the case on the following day. And it reported it in such a way as it made out that the boys were guilty. And what they said was that the boys were punished for a crime that they committed. So it was automatically assumed that the boys had committed the crime. There was absolutely no doubt, according to the Fort Myers Press, that the boys were guilty. It said that these boys were punished for a crime that they committed and that this was a kind of a just punishment. They didn't actually publish any details of the assault, what the boys were accused of doing. They just left it to the imagination of the readers to assume that the boys were guilty.
And what about the role of law enforcement? Would you say law enforcement was more or less complicit?
Well, I think so, because when the lynching is carried out over 2 days and the bodies are dragged up the street, what are the police doing? Why aren't they intervening?
Right.
It would assume that they were complicit. And the first boy was taken from the sheriff. The press says that the sheriff was overpowered. How does that happen? But we also know, we can compare it to an earlier case from 1911 where the previous sheriff, Tippins, was able to avert a lynching because he was able to get hold of the circuit judge and make sure that that case was speeded up. And the Tampa Tribune reports that by saying that the law will be permitted to take its course. In other words, the citizens of Fort Myers have the ability to make sure that if the person isn't brought to trial quickly, that they will carry out the lynching. And Tippins was able to avert that lynching on that occasion. But it shows that the power lies with the community and with the sheriff between them to have the power of life or death over these people.
And I want to come back to this Fort Myers lynching case here in just a minute here, but I'd like to bring James Allen into our conversation now. You're a self-described picker. What do you mean by that term?
Well, for 35 years, I've been buying and selling Southern historical items and objects from people in the South and other dealers and some institutions, and then placing them in collectors' hands and museums and archives. And that's how I came across the first postcard of a lynching of Leo Frank that couldn't be identified even by people who lived within 20 or 30 miles of Marietta where the lynching took place. So that was the impetus of the whole collection and the book.
Thinking back to that time when, you know, that postcard first came into your hand, what kind of reaction did you feel? I was surprised to learn through the Without Sanctuary exhibit, through your work, that these were instances were documented and put on postcards.
Well, they were commercially viable, and they were sold in drugstores and door to door by mail order. You could order them through newspaper advertisements. People mailed them all across the country to their relatives and friends to tell them about the latest events. And sometimes they had messages on the back that they gave a hint of their personal feelings about the events.
Can you share with us maybe what the general character is like of the messages that are written on the backs of these cards?
Well, one that I just immediately comes to mind because it was so shocking and explicit was the lynching of Jess Washington in Waco, Texas, and Robinson, Texas. And a gentleman sent a card to his parents of this image of Jess Washington, boy, hanging from a telephone pole with his charred body where it was burned, and all of these participants and spectators underneath the charred body. It was actually put up there for display, and not just, it wasn't the place of the murder. The sender of the postcard put an X over his head and wrote to his parents, "This is the barbecue we had last night. My picture is to the left with a cross over it. Your son, Joe."
How many photos or postcards have you collected so far in regard to... Go ahead.
About over 200 now.
More than 200, no.
Including documents now and interviews with people that actually participated in a lynching close to town. Just some astonishing groups of letters and the information, just like this Fort Myers lynching, which is just something I've never heard of in depth, just keeps evolving and coming out. And one of the tremendous evidence that comes out of this is that the majority of these men who were murdered never committed a crime.
Right. There was another case, a particularly infamous one of Claude Neal, where some sort of confession to a murder was extracted from him, but how that interrogation actually went down was somewhat questionable. Thinking about the you know, Without Sanctuary, and then that's this collection of you know, documentation of lynching that you have, James Allen. Why is it important for you to, you know, make sure other folks see this, to make sure that people remember that this happened?
Well, Mr. Davis, some of the first off, when we started building the collection, we didn't even know that the first postcard was American. There was nothing to identify it, and it was just so, the most amazing thing about the image was this body hanging in the woods, and these men paying no particular attention to it, looking in all kinds of ways. It was just like they were waiting for the bus, and it was just unbelievable, and I kept it in an envelope and showed it to customers and who had come by that I thought would be interested, and none of them could identify it, even very well-educated people who lived in the town. And then finally one day, I forget how I came across the name of the victim, Leo Frank. He was a white man, Jewish. And then a few months later, a image, someone who knew I had been an avid collector of African-American social history items, came to me at a flea market and offered me a image of a woman, an African-American woman by the name of Laura Nelson from Okemah, Oklahoma, and that was identified. So I was able to get a really comprehensive understanding of what the photographs were, not lynching, but what the photographs were. Then we called around to universities and libraries and counties that I found out had had a number of lynchings, and nobody would admit to having one. Or they'd have one, for instance, in a county, but it would be about a lynching that took place in the county next door. So that really started a certain amount of anger in me that these people had died and was, you know, not only, we don't know if they were buried or not, but their history was buried.
Right.
And that really, through the whole all these years of collecting, between the loneliness of the victims and the fact that, you know, people still want to hide it, and universities and institutions, for the most part, are still afraid of it, just keeps the importance of it. People need to know, and the tales need to be need retelling.
Yeah. Do your images still go on display sometimes in museum exhibits? I think I mentioned to you I did see it more than 10 years ago in an exhibit at the Andy Warhol Museum, and it's haunted me ever since.
Well, the majority of the images are being at the Civil Rights Museum in Atlanta that's being built, and they're constantly requested by institutions all over the world. I would never travel it outside of the United States because I was so scared, because so many of those images are the only one. Mm-hmm. And the majority of them at that point were not identified, which is so important. But there's just constantly requests for participation in seminars, and it's not going away.
And Dr. Harrison, I wanted to bring us back to the case that we're talking about today here. How did that end up impacting the community afterwards?
Well, I think there was a lot of silence, a desire to move on from it and not speak of it. So I think it was buried from public memory in the way that James describes. You know, people didn't want to talk about it. And so I think it's mainly thought of in private and people won't discuss it. What the African-American community did, though, I think, is they started to build their own institutions. And they had Dunbar High School was opened three years after the lynching in 1927. They built their own hospital. They worked a lot through their own churches. So I think they tried to become more independent. They also had a very high level of education. They had the highest rate of literacy among African-Americans in Florida. And I think they used their commitment to education to try and improve themselves. So they had an opportunity to move away from Fort Myers. A lot of them moved away. For example, Melissa Jones, who established the Jones Walker Hospital, she had nine daughters, but only one of them stayed. So a lot of them voted with their feet and moved. But the ones who stayed tried to make themselves as educated as possible so that they could use their intelligence and their qualifications to build a better life and not be dependent on white people, because they'd probably found by that point, they probably felt that they couldn't trust the white community because it hadn't protected them. It didn't bring the people to justice who carried out the lynching, even though the names would have been known. So I think you find the African-American community becoming more self-enclosed and developing its own answers so that it doesn't leave itself exposed to the white community as such.
Mm. And what can you tell us about, you know, efforts to stop the practice of lynching in those times? I know President Franklin Roosevelt had used his, you know, one of his first national radio addresses to really condemn the practice of lynching, but then wouldn't support anti-lynching legislation.
No, that's right. The NAACP was campaigning against lynching right from its formation in 1909. It was mainly publicity, eventually, the Claude Neal lynching.
Yes.
And the one that followed a year later in Miami. These had huge publicity, and because they were now being reported in the New York Times and the national media, it created a great deal of shame. And the South was worried that it wouldn't get investment. The South wasn't economically autonomous. It needed investment from the North. So all these lynchings started to become embarrassing. And I think that that's where the pressure eventually told. It was when it became economically costly to have this bad reputation as a lynching state that the politicians finally did something. The federal pressure, really, until you have the civil rights movement, the federal pressure isn't sufficient. I think it's the shaming and the economic dependence that starts to change things.
Okay. Yeah, the Claude Neal case, I read a description online that you had sent me. That one seemed particularly gruesome.
Very, very gruesome. And, listeners are advised to Google with caution, because yes, it's one of the most even I've seen a lot of atrocities from the Holocaust and from lynching, and that one is particularly bad. He was tortured for 10 hours before he was killed, and you see the state of his body, and it's very, very disturbing. The other disturbing thing, James might comment on this, is that in the photographs I've seen, you often see children and women. And how must this have affected the white children who were invited to participate, watch these lynchings? Brutalizing the white children in this way just seems horrific to me. And you can see it in the photographs. It's very disturbing.
James, is that something that's evident in what you've collected? There's kids at these lynchings.
Oh, I think it was an initiation rite for a lot of children. And in one photograph, the ex-sheriff, an older sheriff, is in the photograph, and the present sheriff was in the photograph. And then his son was also in the photograph. So it was a really just part of growing up. And what did that say when you saw a black man hanging in a tree completely defenseless? And, you know, the power that as a spectator you had over that person.
Well, that is all the time we have for today's show. We've come up on the end of the hour, but I want to thank both my guests. Dr. Jonathan Harrison is a sociology professor at both Florida Gulf Coast University and Hodges University. The history of African Americans in Florida is one of his primary research interests. Dr. Harrison, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, I've loved it. Thank you, John. Yeah. Thank you.
Also, thanks to James Allen. His collection of images documenting the history of lynching in the American South has been made into a book titled Without Sanctuary. You can see some of those images online at www.withoutsanctuary.com. James Allen, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks both to you and Dr. Harrison.
Please. Thanks, James.
There's more information on today's show, as well as an archive of past shows at our website, wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. To comment on anything you've heard on this or any edition of the program, send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. Thanks to my producers Luke Martin and Richard Cinqui. This is WGCU, Fort Myers, 90.1 FM, WMKO Marco, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.